and welcome to the final draft, Books and Writing on 2SER 107.3. I'm Genevieve McGregor. Tonight, two authors who deal in intrigue, bravery and betrayal under authoritarian regimes. First, we hear from Joseph Broad, the first ever journalist allowed to embed with a unit of the Moroccan police. And then Rochelle Fernandez chats with Anna Funda about her latest novel, All That I Am, which is set in the beginning of the Nazi rise to power. All that coming up on The Final Draft. While journalist Joseph Broad was embedded with the Moroccan police, a case file fell into his lap. The seemingly straightforward murder of a warehouse guard during a robbery gone wrong. But the victim's best friend was convinced of a police cover-up, and so he and Broad set out to reveal the truth. Needless to say, they weren't prepared for what they would find. Final Draft's Neda Vanavak spoke to Joseph Broad about conducting a covert murder investigation and the ever-present human desire to know the truth.
Morocco is not Algeria, a country whose government killed 150,000 of its own people. Morocco is not Syria or Tunisia or any of these other contraptions we call states. Morocco is a country with historical continuity and political continuity, and it's a country where the population feels ownership of the idea of Morocco. I was there because I wanted to embed in an Arab police force. These are called police states, and for a reason, and no one had been in the machinery of an Arab security service before. So I approached several governments, and it was the Moroccans who agreed.
They agreed, just like that?
Yeah, I went through the front door. The Saudis turned me down. The Jordanians gave me points for chutzpah. And I think the Moroccans felt that they had something to show off because they had gotten some points from human rights groups in the past for improving on the bloody record of the king's father.
So as far as the Moroccans were concerned, this was like a PR exercise?
Well, they probably thought that they could manage what I saw. They didn't manage to do that. First of all, not everybody got the memo of what I should see, and there were beatings in the shantytown. But also because I found ways to talk to people outside the precinct walls and get another perspective on what was going on inside.
Well, you wrote in the book that the Moroccan domestic intelligence didn't impose any stipulations on you or ask to review your work. I found that quite an interesting thing for them.
Yeah, it's a paradox, I think, that there would be more impositions on an American journalist embedding with American troops in Iraq because the U.S. military has designed a regimented program for those journalists, whereas the Moroccans handled this in a much more informal way. It was unprecedented. So I think I might have actually gained types of access to the Moroccan police that Westerners do not have to their own police forces. They knew this book was coming out, and they could have stopped it, at least by cutting off my access in the middle of the reporting. So I think that it speaks well of them that they subjected themselves to this type of scrutiny.
You write in the book about witnessing the police beating a suspect. How did you balance your own distress at what you saw with a larger desire to have unfettered access to the work that they were doing?
Problem with the embed situation. You want to ingratiate yourself with your hosts, and you end up empathizing with them, but you also need to be honest about what they're doing, and it's sometimes pretty ugly. So not everything that I felt and expressed in the book did I reveal to the people at the time.
Was it a moral issue for you, or was it more of a journalistic imperative to not become involved?
There's no question that one has to tell the story of this beating to the public. On the other hand, the concern would be that by ingratiating myself with the police in the midst of this dark night, they might see it as a moral green light from an American telling them that this kind of behavior is okay.
You wrote also that you were interested in the intersection of authoritarian states and the masses they control. How did you see that intersection being managed day to day?
Well, the police put it to me quite well. They said, we're not just police, we're guardians of the social fabric. So they have three roles. One is the traditional role of order on the streets. Two, as we've seen in television images from all over the Arab world recently, they're protecting the ruler from his own population when things get tough. And three, they claim to be policing the society from its own inner strife. So they're concerned with hushing up sectarian tensions and obscuring incidents of reactionary forces struggling against, say, sexual taboos or magic.
You mentioned in the book the ways in which names are covered up when people that are involved in investigations. There's a culture of not naming, that you cannot name anyone, really. Everything is redacted.
That's right. An article about a crime, all the proper nouns are missing. And that is the concern. They're worried about cycles of vengeance if the family of the perpetrator becomes known to the family of the victim, and issues of shame in a traditional society. So there are some journalists that have been trying to push up against those laws, but they still are the norm.
So I suppose having the case file of Ibrahim Day fall into your lap would have been quite a gift.
It really was. I don't fully understand why I got it. Another, perhaps, manifestation of this informal, on-the-fly sort of arrangement we had. But it was the murder of a homeless squatter, a Berber, in a warehouse that happened to be owned by a Jewish businessman. And the killer was a soldier, an Arab ethnic, from a new counter-terror unit of the Moroccan army. So it had this rainbow of ethnicity, religion, and security and state.
How does one go about conducting a covert murder investigation under a corrupt and authoritarian regime?
Very carefully. The way it began was trying to understand the context of the crime. I met the victim's family and friends, most of whom, one in particular, the victim's best friend, believed that the police were covering up some secret about the crime. And there are lots of conspiracy theories in this part of the world, so I was skeptical at first, but also moved by Mohamed Barry and his need for closure. So I figured if he is willing to take this risk and he lives here, and he will deal with the consequences for the rest of his life, then surely an American coming from far away with a home to retreat to can take that risk with him.
There was an incident in the book where a young boy, Safwan, is brought in with a soldier, accused of having attacked the soldier, and your presence there seemed to prevent any greater violence being done to him. I was wondering what impact your presence as an outsider embedded with the police had on your interactions with civilians.
Certainly, those would be instances in which brutal treatment by the police was inhibited by the presence of an outside observer. I don't know that my presence made a lasting impact on the police whom I encountered. Maybe they feel that, you know, they can let it all hang out again now that I've left. But I also think that the book, in terms of its reception in Morocco, has started a conversation. Moroccans are intrigued to read the book because they've never had this inside view of their police. This type of access was never granted to a Moroccan journalist. And so the beginnings of this conversation, I think, are part of the process of police reform and reconciliation between state and society.
I was really interested to read about your placement in Arab society, given your family background. Your mother was Iraqi, you're Jewish, and being a Jew undercover in the Arab world. How much do you share and how much do you keep to yourself?
I've been traveling in the Arab world for more than 15 years now, and I'm always careful, necessarily careful, about who gets to know that I'm Jewish. A cab driver or a person I encounter on the street, it's never a good idea to advertise my Jewish identity without knowing who's listening. That said, it's not as easy to obscure such things anymore. Anyone is a 10-second Google search away from learning about my background today. I'm more and more open about it, and I think the populations are more open to me.
There's scenes in the book where taxi drivers are expressing fairly racist views and you're in a position where you can't really say anything except sort of neutrally agree with them.
Yeah, you have to swallow a lot in these contexts. It's not so easy emotionally, but it's also very rewarding when you get to know someone who has these views or has grown up around them, and the face-to-face contact and a personal friendship causes a change in outlook.
One of the central focuses of the book is this quest for truth and just uncovering the truth and doing Ibrahim Day the justice of having the truth of his story told. In what way do you think Westerners are not fully cognizant of the value of truth? Is this something that is just taken for granted?
Yes, I think we do take it for granted. Our own police and courts are sometimes vulnerable to corruption, but we take it for granted that the truth eventually comes out, more or less. Whereas in many societies, the truth is a kind of luxury, because the state is keen to impose its own official narrative on the population, and sometimes private narratives, which are inherently messy and complex, get in the way of that. And so the state papers over strange true stories, stories that involve deviance from the normative culture, sexually, religiously, and so on.
How would you characterize the difference in the way that Westerners seek the truth to that of people who live under an authoritarian regime?
Well, Westerners are in a position to push back on their governments through the media, through face-to-face confrontation, and be reasonably assured that there's a separation of powers and they have certain protections that are not guaranteed to other populations. So there's a great deal of subtlety that would be necessary for a private investigation into the truth to be launched in an Arab country. And indeed, there's a whole language that's evolved in authoritarian states around how people communicate honestly to each other without taking a risk of provoking the attention of the security apparatus.
How would they do that?
Sometimes, I'll give you one example. In Saddam's Iraq, there was community theater on every block. And there were plays that were really about Saddam, in which the ruler who was being depicted was George W. Bush or someone else. So everyone knew they were actually talking about their own community, but they used a foreign head of state as a stand-in for their own leader in order to not get themselves killed.
And so when everyone knows, is this just like an unspoken, it's just something that kind of is infused in the society, like they know when it's a double speak?
Yes, I think that it's almost its own language that evolves in a place where people are living under iron rule. And there are stories like this that I've learned about from all parts of the world. It's just a sort of a natural coping mechanism, or it's a tool that people develop out of need.
When you finally uncovered the truth of the circumstances of Ibrahim Day's death, the police reacted, I guess, anticlimactically, given the degrees to which they'd gone to cover up what had happened.
Yes. In the end, it was something that deeply affected those most personally involved. But I guess the police realized that we weren't about to make a big stink of it in Morocco at that time. It was really about my friend's personal need for closure, and I was going off to the United States. So perhaps they didn't feel as immediately threatened by it as they might have under different circumstances. It's easy to imagine that it would have resulted in reprisals for his family and friends. There had been an incident a few weeks earlier in which similar excesses in cultural expression had provoked mass violence in a town in the north. And so the police were papering it over, perhaps with good reason. And it was a few years later that my book came out. I had a bit of trouble deciding whether to tell the whole story. And I found kind of a middle ground, which involved not using the real names of some of the people involved. So there I go, behaving
like
a Moroccan journalist for many of the same reasons. Some people told me, I want my real name in here. I don't care about the consequences. And so their names are there. But others asked to be identified pseudonymously, and I respected that.
That was American journalist and Middle East specialist Joseph Broad speaking with Ned Ivanovac. His book is called The Honored Dead, A Story of Friendship, Murder, and the Underbelly of the Arab World. With Labour's Malaysian solution sunk and the opposition taking Nancy Reagan's Just Say No campaign to new heights, it's easy to just tune out and give up on politics altogether. But perhaps not everyone, everywhere, is as disenchanted as we are. Anna Funder's new novel, All That I Am, is the story of Ruth Becker and her cousin Dora, social democrats in Germany during the pre-Hitler Weimar Republic. Final Draft's Rochelle Fernandez caught up with Anna, author of the hugely successful and award-winning non-fiction book Stasiland, and asked why she chose to write this particular story as fiction.
Well, it was a much easier choice. I would have written Stasiland as fiction, but the stories that I wanted to tell were not believable. They wouldn't have really made a credible novel. You can't write about, a world in which the secret police number one in seven and they can break into your flat and steal your underpants and bottle your bodily odour and train dogs to track you or irradiate you and track you with Geiger counters or put school children in prison for speaking out against the regime or any of those things. I mean, they're almost beyond belief. So, as was the courage of the main characters, the four main characters who were real people in Stasiland. So it wouldn't have been appropriate to write a novel then about them, and in a way the subject matter dictated the form of that book. And this one is, you know, it's thematically a bit similar, but the exercise is different because it's really about getting inside the heads of these, again, four main characters in All That I Am. And that's the one thing that you really can't do. I think that's the, I mean, there are obvious things you can't do in nonfiction, like, you know, tell lies or get it wrong, misrepresent people. But you can't get inside someone's head when you're writing nonfiction unless they tell you what it felt like, what the fear felt like, what the infatuation felt like, what the surprise felt like. You can't impute that to that person. But in a novel, you can really go for it, and you can hopefully inhabit someone else's skin and let the reader do that too.
And did you find the process of writing fiction different to writing nonfiction? Was it easier? Was it harder?
This book was harder. The writing the parts of it that were really just purely fiction. So my narrator, Ruth, there are two narrators, and Ruth lives in Sydney, in contemporary Sydney. Writing all those contemporary Sydney bits was pure joy. It was pure fiction. I didn't need to tie it back into something that really had happened. The other parts were really, I mean, fantastic fun to research. This is based on two true stories, which are about, one is about a refugee who turns and starts informing on his other refugee friends against them to the Nazis in London, and the other story is of two women being found dead very mysteriously in a flat in Bloomsbury. And I looked at all the events around these two happenings, which occurred within weeks of one another, and pieced together a plot. But my basic plot is it involves detective work on my part that involves, you know, obvious fictional leaps.
Right.
But all the people in this book are based on real analogues, but their relationships are different to one another. So I've married people off to one another and made Ruth and Dora cousins and so on. So for dramatic reasons. But that piecing, putting that all together and being faithful to the essence of what happened or what might have happened was like doing surgery or something. So when it came to writing the bits that were purely internal or emotional, that was very liberating. That was a lot of fun.
Your characters in All That I Am, Dora and Ruth, especially Dora, are incredibly courageous and passionate about politics. Do you feel that this sense of engagement and sense of outrage and indignance is lacking in today's society?
It's a very interesting question to know what, members of this little left-wing party, the Socialist Workers Party, would have made of current-day politics. I don't know. They weren't as far left as or as sort of doctrinaire as the communists, but they were further left than our Labour Party, for sure. I think that there are always, and in every society, people who are very sensitive to injustice, and I think it's almost like having an ear for music or having being able to draw or something. I think that, you know, there are different people with different sensibilities, and that this is one of them. This story of people objecting to the abuse of power, particularly governmental power, plays itself out all over the world, in different countries at different times, all the time. So we have seen an almost exact replica of this dynamic in Libya, in Egypt. We see it in China with the imprisonment of writers and dissenters. We see it in Burma. Everywhere where governments seek to accrue unjustifiable amounts of power to themselves, there are always people who will speak out. It does seem unbelievable, that kind of courage, but it exists everywhere, and it's a source of great fascination to me.
Yeah. Would you describe yourself as one of these people who possess that amount of courage by writing? Do you think that you are doing your part to bring these injustices to light?
I was on a panel with Malalai Joya, who is a really extraordinary woman who is a politician with a price on her head from the Afghan warlords, who, you know, really is a wanted woman and is kind of brave beyond belief. You know, she's an activist. I'm not. I think there are certain kinds of courage that are involved in the writing process, but I don't think that they are of that nature. I think that they are different and sort of not really comparable. You know, I wouldn't really compare myself to those people.
Sure. Your character of Dora, especially when she speaks out against she speaks out against women being bound to housework and things like that. And she comes across as a very strong female character. Would you describe yourself as a feminist?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
I was very interested to find that. So this story is taking place in the late 20s, which my characters are young writers and activists and journalists and thinkers in Berlin, and they go night clubbing as young people do, they have sex as young people do, they drink cocktails, they write provocative articles, and so they are quite privileged. When Hitler comes to power, they have to flee and they go to London. They are a generation coming out of this absolutely cataclysmic First World War, so for them, the older generation in Germany that brought about that war is utterly discredited. And a lot of new ideas, the ideas of Freud and lots of new ideas about art and new ideas about politics, are very much alive and being explored. So they were heady, fantastic days, but they were also days of great kind of idealism and exploration. And Dora's part of that was a sexual liberation for women. So women wanted equality in marriage and work, and they wanted the right to abortion. And along with that, my character Dora, and the real Dora Fabian, who she's based on, did say there will never be any true liberation for women as long as women have to bear this double burden of doing all the housework. And I think that that is something that is very much alive today. I do not think that that's an issue that has been solved. I don't think anyone thinks that that's an issue that has been solved.
Mm. And when you do your research, or when you did your research for this and for Stasiland, do you find that history glosses over the role of women, or are there quite a number of courageous, important women that come through when you're reading history? Because I'm very conscious whenever I study anything that it seems to always be men who have pioneered something. It's always men who have put their name to something.
Yes, I think that you're probably absolutely right. I mean, I'm not a historian, so I just pick stories that grab me, or sometimes I feel it's the other way around, that a story will just grab me, that I'm, you know, in Stasiland, I wrote more about women than I did about men, and that's probably because they interested me. But there was a study done that I haven't read, so I'm hoping I'm not misquoting it, but there was a study done about people who resisted the East German regime, which was run by men, and the Stasi was a male, almost entirely male, secret service organization run along military lines. So, and this study found that of the dissenters, and there were very many, so there were a lot of political prisoners under that regime up until 1989, there was a preponderance of women. There were more women than men speaking out about that, and that makes me very curious. I don't know whether it's because women are less likely to take on those positions of power or more likely to be defending family or children. There are a lot of feminist historians who would say that you're absolutely right, but because I'm not one of them, I can't give you a definitive answer.
No, sure. And I know Stasiland was published in Germany, and it got it had a mixed response. There were some who really loved it, and there were some who thought that an Australian had no place writing about German issues. Has All That I Am been published in Germany, and what was the reaction?
All That I Am has just come out in Australia as the first of 16 countries where it's coming out around the world, and Germany is in February next year. Stasiland did get a mixed reaction in Germany. I think that the main reaction to my Australianness that you raised was really to say, why is it that it takes an outsider to tell us these stories and we can't tell them about ourselves? So you have to remember that I was writing this not long after the wall fell. Mm. Everybody in it is walking around the streets, rubbing shoulders with one another. And if I had been West German, the East German people in my book would not have talked to me with anything like the openness that they did, because I came from the other side of the planet. So it was actually a great advantage, which I didn't fully realise at the time I was there, to be, obviously speaking German, but to be foreign.
That was Rochelle Fernandez there talking to Anna Funder about courage, feminism, and her new novel, All That I Am, which is published by Hamish Hamilton. Now, before we go, this October long weekend coming up, young writers from all over Australia will descend upon Newcastle for 5 days of panels, discussions, workshops, and performances. There'll be writers reading cringeworthy early work, talking about where they went wrong, and panels on anything about how to pitch stories to panels on how to save Aussie TV, comedy writing, intellectual property, and queer fiction. To SER's Neda Vanavak spoke to festival co-director Ben Jenkins and Dominic Knight, novelist and writer for The Chaser, about the money to be made in vampire love stories and the joys of spelling bees.
It's a collection of panels and workshops and readings and performances. It's part of the This Is Not Art Festival.
Which in fact is an art festival. I don't know what they're even doing.
Yeah, it's a really misleading name.
Is it sort of like a Dada-esque?
I think it might be.
I think it maybe started off like that. I think like a lot of the Newcastle clientele see a thing, which is this is not art, and get quite excited. Then they turn up and it is art.
Yeah. So we want to make that very clear from the off. It's actually programmed by young writers as well as for. So unlike any other, including the Emerging Writers Festival, you've got basically people in their 20s programming it, people like Ben. Most writers festivals feature writers, but this festival actually is for writers. There are a lot of sessions offering advice, how to pitch books, how to edit books.
So what's the difference then between the Young Writers Festival and the Emerging Writers Festival, which was earlier this year as well? I mean, because it seems like there would be a fair amount of overlap between the two.
Well, the Emerging Writers Festival is new. Our festival's been going for, I think, 10 or 12 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're really coming in on our turf and we resent it. No,
it's sort of a Jets and Sharks scenario.
That's right. No, but the difference is, I think, the whole idea of the term emerging in the arts is that it's not age-specific. So it's people who are starting their career at any age. In the writing scene, of course, there are lots of people in there, sort of middle-aged or even older, who are writing for the first time. And so the Emerging Writers Festival is more tailored to them, whereas our festival is for young writers specifically. So people at university, post-university, plus our festival, people come to Newcastle who probably don't live there mainly. So we all go up there for the weekend and it's got a bit of a camp feel about it.
Yeah.
You sing songs.
Summer camps for writers.
Yeah, basically. And I think those two things, the fact that it is kind of, unless of course you live in Newcastle, but it is sort of cut off. You do feel like you're on a camp. You do feel like you're away for a purpose. You can't just go home. Not saying that you'd want to, but you know.
In many ways it's a hostage situation.
It's trapped, but no, is what I'm trying to say.
But it's great because you commit to it for the long weekend in October and you go up and there are social events. And there are some incredibly theoretical events as well. I'm speaking on a thing called culture jamming in the digital age.
Is culture jamming still relevant in the digital age?
Well, that's what we're going to find out. I'm not going to sort of prejudice what my views may be on the day. Apparently, I've been culture jamming for most of my career. So I don't even know what that means. I just think of it as pranks.
Well, I mean, back in the day, it was spray painting billboards and...
Yeah, like Bugger Up and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, absolutely.
I've always thought of you as sort of the Australian Banksy.
In many ways, yes. Yeah. No, I work with The Chaser, so that's why I get to go on that. But no, I love that the festival, one minute you're talking about how do we make money? And then, how do we actually get money to eat? And the next moment, it's literally this incredibly abstract, esoteric discussion about the nature of social change. It's the charm of the festival, I think.
Absolutely,
Is there a risk that it being in Newcastle is going to alienate some young writers from other parts of the country? I mean, are you planning to do this in other states as well?
I think certainly there is that risk. And we do try and sort of remedy that by really reaching out to artists from the West Coast and from Central Australia. And in some ways, we've been more successful this year than we have in previous.
It's really important that people come up for it. Maybe we'll have satellite events down the track, but I think the core festival being something that you commit to and you go to for a weekend is actually the whole point of it, to be honest.
For sure.
Is this festival about subverting traditional literary practices, or is it something that you're just adding to, enhancing it?
What we want to do is cater to what excites and inspires young writers. And if that falls under something that's more mainstream, if that falls under something that's more conventional, if that falls under something that's more subversive, then so be it. But we're not necessarily setting out to subvert or to kowtow.
People can take whatever they want out of it. What do young writers want to talk about? What do they think they need to know?
Yeah, totally. And in that way, it's kind of self-regulating, because like, there's no way we'd ever have a panel how to write about teenage vampires. Like, while that is pretty practical, and,
that is a guaranteed money maker.
Absolutely.
If you're talking about how do we make money,
is there space in the schedule? But there's also stuff that's just fun. For instance, there's a spelling bee that happens every year, which is just word nerds drinking and
it is
spelling.
Mental.
It's really fun.
I saw it for the first time last year.
It mightn't sound fun, but it is.
It's amazing. It's not only fun, it's like aggressive. It's
fun, F-U-N, fun.
10 points. Have a shot.
But that's going to be really great. We've got Lawrence Lung hosting that this year, and it talking about the program with the Tina body, and they were like, is it possible that this spelling bee could go in the middle of the day? And me and the other co-directors were sort of just outraged. We're like, no, it's a nighttime event. It's a party event. And then, like, as we were saying it, we just sort of realized, God, we're sad. Like, that is... That is not a nighttime event, but it really, really is.
It is. But there's also a festival ball, and, you know, so we're, obviously there's a degree of drinking happens at these things, but yeah, it's essentially...
What would writers be without booze?
Exactly.
Absolutely.
But people do form friendships for life out of this, and Benjamin Law, Marieke Hardy, people like that have come through this Young Writers Festival and ended up, you know, networking in a really amazing kind of career-defining way, and
sure.
A lot of the Frankie team and so on came through. A decade on, it actually does change lives and start careers quite sincerely, and it's been really impressive to see how that happens.
And how is this year's festival differing from previous years? Is there an overriding theme, or is it issues of the day?
Vampires.
Vampires.
As of
teen
5 minutes
vampires.
Ago.
The other co-directors are going to be upset, but I'm putting my foot down. There is such an institutional memory in National Young Writers Festival, so it's sort of hard to see any real delineation from year to year. That being said, like, of course, as Dom mentioned, it's a rolling thing with new co-directors and new festival coordinators every year.
When you look at the literary debates in Australia, when you look at the kinds of things that are being published in mainstream kind of discussion, a lot of it seems to be more established names rather than younger writers or emerging writers, or however you want to balance those terms. How much of a space is there for the young voices, and do they have enough of a platform?
There probably isn't enough, which I think is where the festival comes in. There are actually ways of connecting with industry people at this festival. So publishers do send people along. Agents sometimes come along, and there we've got people you can talk to who work in publishing houses, and if you've got work, you can show them, you can make those connections. There are ways of setting up your own thing. For instance, there's a zine fair, there are lots of people doing it for themselves. We've got a session on how to publish digitally. So we're trying to equip people to sort of subvert and do their own thing and ignore the traditional literary world. And with all the new tools at their disposal, people can actually do it for themselves now, and we're going to try and show them how.
What constitutes young?
I think it's under 30.
No, it's under 35.
Under 35.
Which is important to me because I'm 34. A lot of people do start being serious about writing slightly later in life. So early 20s probably wouldn't work. But there aren't many people at the festival who are older than mid-30s, which makes it really exciting.
That was Dominic Knight, writer for The Chaser and board member of the National Young Writers Festival, speaking with Neda Vanovac. If you'd like more information on the festival, you can view the full program at www.youngwritersfestival.org. The link will be on our website. On the Corner is up next, so we'll speak to you next week. Thanks for listening.